Reefer Madness the Podcast would like to acknowledge that we produce our shows on Treaty 2 territory and homeland of the Métis. We pay our respects to the First Nations and Métis ancestors of this land, and we reaffirm our relationships.
It's Reefer Madness the Podcast with Trevor and Kirk.
Kirk, we're back.
Hey, Trevor, how are you?
Good. So let's start with the interesting stuff. Kirk, you're not even in Manitoba anymore. Where did you get off to?
I'm back in Lac-la-Biche, small town Alberta. We're on our way to Banff, and we're on our way to Vancouver Island. We're taking Van Hoot for a little spin to Vancouver Island for March and April.
Sounds nice. So I found an interesting CEO slash pharmacist slash, well, she's a several things on the LinkedIn. Sarah Robertson, you had to listen to the interview. What do you think about her and her company, Cicatrix Labs?
Yeah, so you found yourself a kindred spirit, someone else that's in the suppositories.
Yes, don't read too much into this, but Sarah is a pharmacist. She's in that slightly divergent field from mine. She went through the hospital pharmacy world, but she is now the CEO of a company that's making cannabis products, and the one it sounds like they're doing other stuff, but right now they have suppositories. And as I probably mentioned before, I think suppositories are awesome, and we've actually had several guests on previous episodes who've talked about how much suppositories are a good thing. Everyone from when you were talking to the Victoria Cannabis Buyers Club and they're teaching people how to make suppositories, to Kylie Bowdery has mentioned it in sort of, we'll call it sexual health. Even when we were talking to people about IBS and not just IBS, but all the inflammatory bowel diseases. We've had to talk to a couple of people in a couple of different spots. Having cannabis go to that area is good.
Yeah, I listened to the episode a couple of times, and you had me back in my books. I don't think I've read as much about the route of administration of drugs as I have in the last couple hours. And people have to realize that when you choose use a suppository, you're using it for various reasons, right? The route of administration of a medication directly affects the drug's bioavailability, and how that means how you get it into your system. And healthcare practitioners need to make choices. Some drugs you can take it orally, some drugs you can take rectally, but some drugs you can do both. And I guess the thing is that as practitioners, we have to decide when it is advantageous to take a drug rectally.
And we have to remember, Cicatrix Labs is not just rectally, they have vaginal as well.
And they also have, I think, dermal as well, transdermal.
I said we'd get back to Sarah when they've got some topicals, because I like them. I like them too for similar different reasons. Routes other than oral are very interesting to a pharmacist.
Well, of course. I mean, as a nurse, you have to, I'm the one administrating it. As a pharmacist, you're sort of putting it into formulation in which I use. So, you know, how convenient is the drug? When do you want to use oral versus when you want to use rectal? What's the patient? Is the patient conscious? Can they swallow? Sometimes you may want to give an unconscious patient a rectal medication because it's just easier. What's the onset you want from the medication? Is the patient cooperative? Excuse me, sir. Good morning. I have something for you. You know, the nature of the drug and how you want the drug absorbed is important. The age of the patient's important. And also the effects. So one thing we should talk about, maybe a quick definition, first pass metabolism. Do you want a quick synopsis from a pharmacist?
Sure. So when you take something orally, the first place all the blood from the stomach and intestines go, so gets absorbed, leaves the GI tract, the first place it goes is the liver. The liver's got many jobs, but one of its big jobs is it metabolizes, it breaks down, it filters all the blood in the body. And so that makes sense that food goes sort of straight to the liver because, you know, it sort of breaks it down into, helps break down to its component parts and sends it off to all the right places. But in pharmacy world, that means that a lot of drugs or a lot of a drug, depending on the drug, will get broken down in the liver before it goes anywhere in the body. And we call that first pass metabolism, meaning you can lose a lot of the drug's effect before it goes anywhere. But if you do not go via mouth, if you go, say, rectally or topically or injection or under the tongue, if you go non by the mouth, you can skip that, go through the liver and break things down. So that can often mean you can get same effect with a lower dose if you can sort of skip the liver or skip that first pass metabolism.
Well, and I was telling you, you had me reading my papers, and one of the things I was reminded about is that it's not just the liver, right? It's also the intestines absorbs a little bit of the drug, the liver absorbs it, and also the lungs. So there's sort of three components that you're going through when you take a med orally. The other thing I had to be reminded about is that the upper rectum is different than the lower rectum.
Yeah, and I will... And someone can complain that I have this a little wrong, but in pharmacy school, they talked about it being 2/3 of the drug that went rectally would skip the first pass metabolism, and 1/3 would go through the liver, making it a little more complicated. And the way it was explained to me was because different parts of the intestine have different blood flows, and some go to the liver and some don't. So that's how I understood it in pharmacy school. But when I, because, you know, that was a long time ago, I did a little bit of reading too, and places I read said somewhere between half, some said half, some said a quarter, some said a third. So we'll say some rectal stuff goes to the liver and some doesn't, because honestly, I'm not 100% certain on my pharmacy school 2/3, 1/3 number anymore, but I think I'm safe in saying some skips the liver.
Yeah, and agreed. And that's I think in the lower part of the rectum, most of it skips the liver, and some goes to the liver. But if you put it up higher up into the rectum, and you're starting to get more and more into the first pass mechanism.
Sarah does a great job, better job than us, explaining how our company came about and what they're doing and where they're going. So let's listen to Sarah from Cicatrix Labs.
So my name is Sarah. I'm a pharmacist by trade. Started out in hospital practice, kind of in the interior health area. Moved on to community practice and then worked in long-term care. I've done a little bit of kind of the research and development of products in the past, and just a little bit of everything. Kind of got a start into the cannabis industry, working in an integrated health pharmacy, so working through patients' medications and their natural health products, and then including cannabis in that therapy. So really kind of coming from kind of the medical background, and then got into Cicatrix Labs.
And that was going to be one of my questions. So it's pronounced Cicatrix Labs?
It is, yes. I know it's a bit of an odd
No. Once you get it, I think that sticks with you. So we're talking suppositories today, because that's sort of where I first saw Cicatrix Labs and you on LinkedIn. Also a pharmacist, and we in the past have compounded a bunch of different types of suppositories. So I'm probably... got an unhealthy obsession with suppositories. So I love the fact you are doing suppositories, but let's start with, to make sure I pronounce it right, what's the brand name of your suppository?
It's a Swage.
So
give you a little bit of background on why we picked the name. So Cicatrix is actually, so when you have a cut and it starts to heal over, the first stage of healing creates what's called a cicatrix. So indicative of healing, what we're kind of trying to focus on in our company.
And that's great. That's a great name.
Yeah. Then assuage is to kind of lessen discomfort. So, you know, as we can see with the names, we're a very kind of medical focused company. And we're specifically looking at kind of alternative formats that we haven't really seen on the market, to try to give patients some kind of different options. So being a pharmacist, you know, when everything first came out, I mean, we were looking at flower and 30 milligram per mil oils. That was kind of it. Now that we're starting to kind of evolve the industry, we're able to get into some of these, from a pharmacy standpoint, a little bit more exciting types of formats and different pharmacokinetic profiles. And we're really just looking to give people some options. So when we looked at kind of what's available on the market and what people were asking for, the first gap that we saw was really the suppositories, where they're being used by patients across Canada. Most patients are making their own. So to try to kind of make those available, we've come out with a fairly kind of broad range of the kind of THC and CBD products. That you're not having to kind of mix by yourself and put them in the fridge and kind of, guess as to your potency and your stability and your sterility, that sort of a thing. So those just launched this week.
Yeah. And from some of the previous episodes we've had, I'm really glad that somebody is in the suppository area. Like we talked with the Victoria Cannabis Buyers Club, and they've been sort of helping cancer patients for years make their own suppositories at home. And listeners, don't yell at me, but honestly, as a pharmacist, I was a little bit horrified to hear that people were making their own suppositories at home. Not that I don't think you can do it, but that's kind of the whole point of pharmacy and the pharmaceutical is to sort of make things the same every time, and sterility, as Sarah was just mentioning. So yes, I'm really glad of this. And then we've had other guests on previously, from Kylie Beaudry, who has been talking about vaginal suppositories for sexual dysfunction issues, to we've had people with Crohn's and colitis who have in the past had we'll call it cannabis related suppositories. So this sounds like a big area you've gotten into.
It is. Yeah. I mean, I honestly had the same reaction when I saw both some of the homemade and kind of, we had some circulating around the area from, kind of legacy markets and that sort of thing. And it's, unfortunately, it is a more complicated thing to make. I mean, if you're making one or two, it's not as big a deal, but if it's something you're going to be using regularly, the amount of testing that we have to do on each batch is just incredible. Everything is tested in terms of the inputs, pesticides, heavy metals, aflatoxins, all the rest of it. Plus then we have, multi-step sterility testing, and then plus the stability testing. So looking at, is it still sterile in 3-6 months? And especially at room temperature. So we've been able to kind of develop that process, starting off with kind of the compounding pharmacy base and then working it up to a truly kind of industrial process. And it is a bit more challenging because it is used for so many different things. So we really wanted something that was kind of multi-use. So we have, gone for both the rectal and the vaginal administration, which is, it's actually very similar in terms of the product requirements, but then the testing requirements are quite different.
Oh, that's, I was going to say, I had no idea what sort of differences in testing do you have to do a rectal versus vaginal suppository?
Mm-hmm. The main thing is on the bacterial count. So if you're going to be using them rectally, there's a reasonably wide kind of range in terms of your total aerobic count and your total yeast count. That's dropped by a factor of 10 if you're going to use them vaginally. Plus, then you have to do specific testing for certain organisms, both bacterial and fungal, just to make sure that you're not going to be causing a problem.
Oh, that's very cool. I know it's not the same, but my pharmacist brain goes to eardrops and eye drops, where, it's okay to put an eye drop in the ear because it's more sterile, but don't put an eardrop in the eye. So a vaginal suppository is more sterile?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, it's, like I said, it's kind of a factor of 10 dilution for how many bacteria and yeast are allowed. And we aim to go significantly below that with our personal standards within the company as well.
That's great. So actually that segues nicely into, so your different Assuage products, I sort of have the printout here. You go everything from CBD only, and frankly up to a pretty strong CBD, up to a THC only, and kind of a mix. You want to talk about the different formulations you have?
Yes. So you want to give patients an option, like, just because there are so many different indications that people are using these for. Like you said, we've got anything from kind of cancer patients who tend to be using quite high dosage, right, to kind of the recreational use. You know, if you look in the States, there's all sorts of recreational suppository brands. We just haven't seen the uptake here, which is quite surprising. So with the CBD, you know, we have the option, I guess our lowest formulation is 50 milligrams straight CBD. We're coming out near the end of February with the extra strength and ultra strengths, 100 and 200 milligrams. And those are still in the smaller suppository size. So just like the 1.3 mil, kind of 1.1 gram. Okay. And then on the THC side, we have starting off with a 1 to 3. So the 10 milligram THC and the 30 milligram CBD. And then coming out with a just straight kind of 10 milligram THC. Just to kind of, you know, give people the option of where they want to start. You know, a lot of our patients will actually start with only half of the suppository, just especially when you're first trying out a CBD or a THC product. You know, if you're not as familiar with the format, it has that kind of comfort of, you know, our traditional mantra as pharmacists of, you know, start low and go slow.
So tell the listeners a little bit how, so suppositories just in general, not just cannabis ones, are different than pills on how stuff is absorbed and goes to the liver or doesn't go through the liver. Do you want to just do a quick primer on that for someone who hasn't thought as much about suppositories as you before?
Yeah, so we have kind of an odd regulatory framework with it. So the THC suppositories are kind of limited to 10 milligrams per unit right now because they fall under the extract class. Now there's preliminary evidence that shows that especially with the rectal suppositories, that you're probably going to be bypassing the first pass metabolism. So metabolism is quite different. Now, we need more studies on this kind of long-term in terms of how that actually translates into use. Now, we know anecdotally that when you're looking at how people are using these, they're tolerating much higher THC doses with the rectal format than they have been with oral. And they're using them in a different way. So there's definitely, you know, some evidence that there's probably a different pharmacokinetic mechanism there. There's different absorption. And we're hoping to be able to get some clarity on exactly how that actually translates into effect for some of these conditions that are being used for. What we're seeing on the other side of that is when it's not being used for a systemic condition like pain, it's being used really for its local effects.
Okay.
So most of the patients that we've seen that have been kind of knocking on our door trying to get a hold of these products, you know, you're looking at things like endometriosis, looking at pelt like cysts, ovarian cysts, or like as you said before, the kind of the sexual dysfunction. So there's, you know, there's obviously a need there. There's kind of a historical usage. And now that we're kind of bringing this into a legal product, it allows us to get that data out in a safe way where we know that the products are not contaminated. You know, we know that they're being overseen by a physician and a pharmacist, and it can start to kind of come, you know, into that more medical light where we can start treating it like another natural health product, you know, where it is really part of a generalized therapy plan.
Cool. You'd mentioned in the U.S. there being a lot of recreational, or at least some recreational suppositories. Is your product going to be strictly medicinal? Is it going to be available in rec stores? I guess, how would somebody get their hands on one if they thought this was something they wanted?
So we're starting off in the medical market. We are hoping to expand to the recreational market kind of after that. But to get that kind of preliminary data, we did want to start, you know, in a more, you know, somewhere where people have better access to information. So one of the problems that we have with recreational stores, of course, is the bartenders aren't allowed to tell you anything about the product.
Right.
So in an area where these haven't been used before, you know, as much, or they've been using kind of their own homemade, you know, there's a bit of a learning gap there. So we wanted to, when the patient comes in, we wanted them to have access to that information. You know, how do you use these? How do you store these? How do you use them safely? How do you integrate it with the rest of your therapy? And really, you know, that needs to be in the medical market. Now, once that's kind of available, and again, once you start moving more into the recreational side of it, which also has quite a large following, you know, then we will be kind of moving into the recreational kind of provincial stores as well.
Cool. So now I want to ask about usage, but just sort of honestly, this is an honestly, I don't know. In traditional pharmacy world, we have indications, stuff that we're allowed to say, you know, this drug is good for X. Can you, are you allowed to say your product has an indication, or how does that work? And then even if it doesn't, what sort of things do you think people are going to be using it for?
Well, the word indication is a little bit difficult when it comes to cannabis. I mean, there are official indications for cannabis. They're quite limited. Generally speaking, like you're looking at studies that were done for chronic pain, for nausea and vomiting with chemotherapy, or for dystonias. Those are really the only kind of official indications. Now, that said, that's not what we see in real life.
Right.
What the actual usage is and how people have been benefiting from them hasn't really been followed by the literature, because unfortunately the studies just haven't been done as yet. And luckily, since legalization, those studies are now starting to happen. So we're seeing some very interesting kind of preliminary data, both on suppositories and on the topical side. So in terms of true indication at the moment, I probably would not be, I'm fairly conservative, but I probably wouldn't use that word yet.
Fair enough.
That said, what we're seeing it used for, and, you know, on an anecdotal level, seeing that they do work for, it tends to be that pelvic pain.
Okay.
You know, we have people using them for cancer, for the rectal root. We have, you know, some fairly good evidence that CBD is anti-inflammatory. So we're seeing it used for Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, even like IBS and hemorrhoids seems to be a fairly common one as well. On the vaginal side, we're seeing it used for painful sex. Tends to be a big one.
Okay.
Again, we're seeing CBD has that anti-inflammatory. It has, you know, some blood flow effects. So it's a logical thing to, you know, to be studying and to be using. In terms of other kind of pelvic pain, I mean, we have very, very limited treatments for things like ovarian cysts and for endometriosis. I mean, you basically, you know, you've got some hormonal therapies, and then you've got, you know, NSAIDs and, you know, some pain treatments. And after that, you're really out of options. You know, you start to get into things like major surgeries, which then have their own issues and cause, you know, fibrosis and scarring. And, you know, there really is a huge need for another line of therapy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, the first option that's been available for a while. So, you know, we do want to get this into the hands of physicians and into hands of patients, and to start to be able to track, you know, how it's being used, what the benefits are, how it's kind of being taken up into the rest of their therapy, and then to kind of start to narrow it down. Why does this work? How does it work? So that we can start to kind of build those algorithms that are more used, like what we're used to as pharmacists and physicians, where you can look at, you know, your indications and your contraindications, and, you know, really start to integrate it into these, you know, therapeutic guidelines and pathways that we're all used to using.
That's good. And I can hear Kirk chirping in my ear, so I know what he'll ask. He would be asking, so are there any actual ongoing studies or beginnings of studies, let's say, on endometriosis and suppositories possibly that you're involved with?
We're just getting started on that. We have some stuff in the works, but I can't quite get into details about that as yet, unfortunately.
Fair enough. Means we might have to get you back on later.
Yeah, it's, you know, once we get to take so long to get through all the regulatory process. So now that we've got, you know, everything kind of in place, we're hoping that things move quite a bit faster. We can start to kind of get these going. But we are going to be kind of right off the bat tracking usage and indication. And some of that kind of preliminary data on is kind of how, like I said, how these are being used, who's using them, why are they using them, which then helps to narrow down some of our kind of more advanced studies.
Okay. And we'll see if they, but I should be a good pharmacist. I was reading through your sort of how to use things. So let's talk about lube, condoms, and panty liners. So what's a good lube if we're going to be using your suppositories?
Honestly, they're fairly easy to use. We put that in there just because it's, you know, some people are a little bit intimidated by the format. Now, this is part of the reason why we went with the smaller format. We're looking at, you know, it's 1.1 grams. So it's the traditional kind of child size. So they're not nearly as unapproachable as some of the ones that we've seen kind of on, especially on the legacy market.
Oh, and I understand. We used to compound something we literally called a rectal rocket. It was enormous, but it had a big flared end, so it would sort of stay right at the anal sphincter for hemorrhoids. I know. I like suppositories way too much. Okay. So lube, probably not such a big deal, but any water-based lubricant, I assume, would be fine if that's what someone is interested in.
Exactly. It's basically, it's just to help with insertion, or you can just kind of warm them up or even just use water just to kind of start that melting process. Just so that they're a little bit easier to put in. But yeah, generally speaking, we haven't had any really main kind of issues with that. The main thing to be aware of is they are basically, you know, they're an oil base in them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, any kind of latex, you're absolutely, you know, going to run into some issues. So that's in terms of any kind of condoms or toys or anything like that. So just kind of the long-term breakdown. And that's the case with kind of any oil-based lube or suppositories. But yeah, we're hoping to kind of come up with a more kind of complete line of products that kind of, and we will expand on kind of that sexual health market, because it is fairly limited at the moment. In terms of kind of the panty liners and that sort of a thing, again, because it's such a small volume, it hasn't been as much of an issue as with kind of the larger ones, just because it is, you know, it's only 1 mil, but it's one of those things. Nobody wants to get anything ruined. So it's always a good idea to, especially the first time you use them, just in case.
Nope. Those are all great, because I think I would have thought of the lube. Honestly, I probably wouldn't have thought of the latex condom. So that's bad on me. And I definitely, the panty liner wouldn't have occurred to me. So yes, if I'm talking to anyone in a professional capacity, I will remember those. Those sound like fantastic counseling tips. So I've covered, now there's lots more going on with your company and these products, but I think I've covered the basics. Anything else you wish I'd ask or thought I was going to ask or really wanted our listeners to know?
No, that's the main kind of the main points on them. I mean, it's such a, like I said, kind of a broad indication for use in terms of, you know, what we're seeing between the rectal and the vaginal use. I think they really have, you know, the opportunity, you know, to help a lot of people. And we're hoping to kind of have the full product line available, you know, within the month. And then we're starting on some very interesting topicals next.
So sound great. Oh, I probably should. So you have a patient who's interested, is the way they get them now go through their doctor, then their doctor fills out a medical form on your website and it goes that way? How does it actually get to somebody?
Yeah, so there's a few different ways to do it. So it is through the kind of medical cannabis program, which does require the physician authorization. So that can either be through your family doctor or your specialist that you're seeing, or you can go through some of our providers. So they have some amazing physicians that are very informed about cannabis and sometimes a little bit more comfortable than some of the family physicians. You know, when you're first looking at a medical authorization, I think as a family physician, it's a bit intimidating. It's such a different process. You know, you're used to just writing out, you know, your drug and your dose and your administration, and, you know, you bring it to the pharmacy, it's very simple. Because it's an authorization for use and you still have to write it in grams per day, even though like the equivalence is...
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense for suppositories, but it's still on there.
No, it has, and it has nothing to do with the strength of the product whatsoever. So either the physician can kind of fill out the authorization forms and send it in to either of our medical providers, or they can refer on to one of the cannabis clinics, and that's kind of all online. You have a meeting with one of the cannabis physicians. They go through kind of your medical history and provide any information, and they do a wonderful follow-up. So if you do have any questions, you know, they're always kind of available, you know, either kind of on your time or theirs. Just give them a call and they'll answer any questions you have.
I think that's a great place to wrap it up. Thank you very much. This was very interesting. And yeah, when you come up with topicals and or sort of more studies on endometriosis, we'd love to talk more. Thank you very much for your time, Sarah.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much.
Kirk, I you know, like you said, maybe a kindred spirit. I talked to somebody for, you know, 20-30 minutes about suppositories, and she's a pharmacist and she has her own company, and maybe I'm a little jealous. Anyway, so I, of course, just loved that conversation with Sarah. What did you think about what they're doing?
I thought it was kind of cool. Like I said, it forced me to get back into my books. I like the fact that there's another route in which you can use your cannabis. I went to her webpage and I was trying to figure out how small are these? She doesn't have anything to comparison. They must be very tiny.
She did actually say in there, now you've probably seen this, maybe people out there, so it made sense to me, but I think the key for people to hang their hats on is this is sort of a child size suppository. So if, as a parent, you've ever given a child like a child size glycerin suppository or a child size Tylenol suppository, or
right.
So it's little. Ballpark, sort of the tip of my little finger, but skinnier, because right. I've got fat fingers. So like she said, they intentionally went with, I think I'm not going to word as well as hers, but a less intimidating size. So, I got to mention again, we used to make something called rectal rockets, which were forking huge. And yes, people were intimidated by them, but that was kind of the whole point, is they had sort of a flared end at one end. So it's just sort of held it there in the rectal sphincter. So yes, people kind of, their eyes got real big when you showed them the rectal rocket for the first time. Go, no, it's not as bad as you think. But anyway, this is a much, much smaller suppository. So should be far less intimidating to use for the first time.
And using a water-based lube. I have a question for you. When you compounded suppositories back in the day, did you use glycerin or did you use fat? I mean, I'm wondering, in her, did she get into this? She used glycerin or she using lipids?
Lipids. She actually, I flipped through some of her. Yeah, so I've got her sheet here that. So they're using glycerides, which are a type of fat, 10 to 18 length, like the chain fatty acids. So basically it's a fat, and and it says specifically on there, do not use if allergic to coconut oil. So it's a fat. It's probably not exactly the same, but one of the bases we used was called MBK, which was just a fatty thing. Way back to pharmacy school, we used to make a lot of suppositories with cocoa butter, which was interesting. Not trying to bore people, but okay, remember, suppositories, fascinating. So why we liked cocoa butter is because it melts at body temperature, right? So that makes sense for a suppository. But the complicated part about making them is, so when you make a suppository, you heat up the base, you put your ingredients in, and they cool it off in a mold, right? Makes sense. But with cocoa butter, if you heat it up too much while you're making it, you actually change its melting point, so now it would not melt at body temperature. So you'd screw it up just in the making if you heated it up too much. So when I made them, that was in pharmacy school, when I made them in real life, never use cocoa butter. We always use something called MBK or something very similar, because it didn't have that sort of dual melting point problem. But anyway,
yeah,
people don't need to care about all the ins and outs of making suppositories. But yes, it sounds like a similar sort of base. So basically a fatty base, an oily base is what they're using.
And the more oily base, the longer the release.
Well, there's a couple things going on. And Sarah, if I'm speaking out of turn, you know, email me and I'll put out an apology. But so oil, good, because cannabinoids, oily. So we got to have something that holds it. Oil, good, because it like if it's water soluble, it's just not going to last sort of as long when we put it into the rectum. Most suppositories are sort of in an oil base. That's just kind of the standard. That's just kind of how they hold together the best. And with the fatty things, you can adjust the melting point. Again, in a perfect world, it should be solid at room temperature, but melt at body temperature. And that's actually not that far apart. But because there's different lengths of fatty acids, you can play with that a lot more. So that's some of the reasons we like quote unquote oil based stuff.
Okay, yeah, because I was looking at again from the article and relearning the whole route of medications was that the fattier the lipid that makes the drug, also how it absorbs. And I think it's more how it absorbs through the intestines than maybe the rectum. One of the other things I wanted to remind myself about, and I couldn't find it, maybe I indirectly answered the question, when you absorb medication through the rectum compared to the through the intestine, higher doses to the rectum usually?
No, what we're hoping is you can actually get away with a lower dose versus oral. And again, that's the whole missing the liver. That's the whole missing the first pass metabolism. And I just want to throw in just two more. Remember, they also do vaginal stuff. And this I know even less about, but the reading I had didn't have any of the vaginal absorption going through the liver at all. So not that 2/3, 1/3 of the rectum. So as far as I can tell, you should get sort of 100% miss the liver vaginally. And the other thing is sometimes we want a local effect, not a systemic, not the whole body. So especially with some of the vaginal suppositories, if the problem really was just painful sex, we want the effect locally. So we're kind of less worried about how much gets absorbed in the rest of the body. But if you were using it for inflammatory bowel disease, you'd want it to be absorbed to the whole body because it's more than your bowels that are inflamed. But sometimes we're shooting more for a local effect and sometimes we're shooting more for a systemic effect. And Sarah mentioned it, but I just wouldn't be a good pharmacist if I didn't mention oily suppositories don't play well with latex condoms. So just, yeah, got to keep that in mind, especially if we're doing this vaginally, let's say for painful sex. Well, so, you know, you that's an important precaution to throw out there. Latex doesn't like oily stuff.
Okay. I wanted to just a little bit remind listeners that this is not the first time we've discussed endometriosis on this on this podcast.
Yeah, no, that was interesting.
Episode season 3, episode 2, Kind of Curious. We were talking to David Berg about the strain print endometriosis study, which I sent to you and we read, but I thought it had something to do with suppositories. It doesn't. It's more oral use, but cannabis use for endometriosis, and there's some positive effects. I'm wondering if we haven't already attached it to Dave's, maybe we'll attach it to this in the webpage.
Yeah, no, I think that'd be a great idea. And I, again, future episode, maybe it would be really cool if some of Cicatrix Labs suppository studies on endometriosis come to fruition and we can ask later about, hey, how did that go? But yeah, I don't know how to nicely segue from butt stuff to cannabis tours, but Kirk, we also have a My Cannabis story.
Another one from Calgary, I presume.
Another one from Calgary. So Kananaskis Tours. Now, Kananaskis spelled differently. So from the Alberta area, you know Kananaskis is a beautiful mountainous area just outside of Calgary. I've happened to have even gone there and done some hiking many years ago. Beautiful area, but there is a guy we met at Hempfest in Calgary who will start you off in the city proper and take you on a tour, and I think he describes it better than we do.
Yeah, let's listen to another Mike Cannon story from Calgary.
Hi, so again, we're at HempFest, and we are at Kananaskis for cannabis tourism. First, introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about what you do.
Hi, my name is Dave Dormer. I am the owner and operator of Kananaskis. Basically, I have been a journalist for the last 23 years. I have been a stoner for the last 22. I put those two things together and I made Kananaskis. It's Alberta's first fully legal, fully licensed cannabis tourism operation. What I do is I teach the history of cannabis. I pick people up in Bridgeland, Calgary. It's in the northwest part of the city. And the first stop is we make at a dispensary because legally I can't provide cannabis because I'm not a retailer. I am a tour operator. So we stop. I partnered with 5 Point Cannabis in Bridgeland. We stop there. People can bring their own cannabis from home if they want, or else they can buy from 5 Point, which is a cannabis art gallery and dispensary. I think that's kind of a neat thing here today. You guys can't see it because this is an audio podcast, but we have the art of McKenna Prather. She is the featured artist right now at 5 Point, so we have some of her stuff here. So we make a stop there, and then I have kind of two tours that I do. One, I take people to Kananaskis Country, and that's spelled with a K. That's just west of Calgary. It's a very popular mountain area where we have lunch, which is provided by Butterfan Catering. And on the drive out, I teach you the 12,000-year history of cannabis. And when we get out to the mountains, it's one of the most beautiful smoke spots that you'll ever see. And we have lunch, and I have a bunch of artifacts that you can see and touch. And we can talk about the history of cannabis, where it comes from, why the words are the way they are, how things got to be the way they are. And then we spend a day in the mountains, and then we come back. And also do a, which is a really popular, it is the same tour, but it is at Heritage Park, and it's a dinner tour in the evening. It's from 6 to 9 p.m. on Wednesdays through Saturdays. And basically, same thing, I pick you up in Bridgeland, we make a stop at 5 Point Cannabis, and then I take everybody to Heritage Park, where they allow me to set up and operate. And what I do is I set up, call it a mini cannabis museum. I have all my artifacts. I have the handwritten court record of the first Canadian, or one of the first Canadians, to get caught as what would be considered a major dealer.
Wow.
I have, you know, photos of some of the first major dealers. I have the copy of the Shenan Bengkao Jing. It's the first, the earliest book that ever mentions cannabis. It's written in 2700 BC.
Wow.
Copy of the McFarland Thai English Dictionary. That's the earliest written reference to the word bong. So we talk about sort of like why cannabis is the way it is, where the word cannabis comes from, you know, how did hash get invented, or yeah, how did it get created, how did cannabis spread around the world, and it's a fun night for people that enjoy cannabis and want to learn more about it.
Kirk, that sounded awesome. I was a little sad we weren't in Calgary long enough to go on one of those tours, and then my next thought was, there should be something like that around Riding Mountain, like close to where we live.
Unfortunately, in Manitoba, you can't smoke cannabis or consume cannabis anywhere but your home.
Yeah, but the Riding Mountain is a national park.
And you cannot consume cannabis in any national park in Canada. I've posted signs on this on Instagram. You don't follow my Instagram account?
Apparently, I missed that episode. But anyway, that would so be... Anyway, there's got to be... We've got to find a loophole. There's got to be a loophole because...
Well, that's the thing about cannabis in this country. You got to know the rules about where you're consuming and what you're carrying. And we speak to that in our blog on reefermed.ca. So yeah, we discussed that in there about where do you consume cannabis in this country.
Yeah, apparently not at Riding Mountain.
Not in Riding Mountain National Park.
But if you're in the Kananaskis area, you could.
Provincial Park, I don't know the rules. We'd have to know the rules of... you know what? I may know the rules this week because I'm going down into a provincial park. So maybe I'll find out.
All right. So that was another good one. I think unless you've got some burning music request, I think we'll let Renee pick one. So I'm Trevor Schufeld, I'm the pharmacist.
And I'm still Kirk Nyquist, the registered nurse, and we are Reefer Medness, the podcast. You can find us on all your social media. We're on Spotify, we're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, we're on YouTube. We have a YouTube channel now. And we're also on the internet there, that www.reefermed.ca. Just give us a review and, you know, support the podcast. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, you can go to our relationship page and we discuss there how you can help us with this passion project. We're looking for advertisers, and you can buy yourself a Hoppy pillow, which we can segue into now.
Hey, here's something cool. Reefer Madness Hoppy Dreams Pillows. We've had a local group of artisans create a limited supply of these pillows to reward supporters of our podcast. These sachets, stamped with our logo, of course, are made from repurposed hemp material and are stuffed with a special blend of dried hops, lavender, chamomile, and rose petals. This aromatic combo helps induce slumber and promote sweet dreams. As you know, Reefer Madness, the podcast, is a reliable and popular source of cannabis information, and we want to keep it going for many years to come. That's why we're asking for your support and rewarding you with this one-of-a-kind gift. Send us a pledge of $80 Canadian or more, and we will send you a sweet Hoppy Dreams pillow. To get yours now, we're asking for a minimum pledge of $80 Canadian. Just go to reefermed.ca and click on the Relationships tab. There's a limited supply of these Reefer Madness, the podcast collector's items, so why not click over there now? Then look forward to an awesome sleep, knowing you supported our fun and informative passion project.
Okay, so that's another good one. So I'm really pleased that we got to talk about suppositories. I'm sure that was on your tick sheet when we first started.
It really was.
Yeah, I know.
If I can fit another suppository episode in, any excuse.
We'll get part two.
All right, guys, that was great. It was another good one. It's Renee here back in the studio, charged with the responsibility of playing a song at the end of this episode. So, I'm not sure why this song came to mind on this episode of Suppositories, but anyway, it's by a band called Lights, and it's called Up We Go.
Sorry, let's say it right. Her and her company, Cicatrix. See, I think I got it better that time. I wrote it down phonetically this time. Cicatrix Labs, Sarah Robertson. I don't know if Renee wants to make that sound better, but or just leave it in that I can't pronounce things. Cicatrix Labs.